on the starter's gun in the satellite race. Both U.S. and Soviet scientists had already been developing artificial satellites and a suitable launch rocket or rocket package for almost a decade. In early October 1945, 1 month after the formal end of World War II, the U.S. Navy had established the Committee for Evaluating the Feasibility of Space Rocketry. Also formed in 1945 and also charged with producing a feasibility study was the Army-Navy Joint Guided Missile Committee. Two top secret operations, Overcast and Paperclip, had transported hundreds of tons of equipment, vast quantities of technical documentation, and scores of newly laundered Nazi rocket scientists and engineers to the United States, including Wernher von Braun and Arthur Rudolph. By 1946, new consultative frameworks such as Douglas Aircraft Company's Project RAND and President Truman's Air Policy Commission were hard at work. Recall that RAND's first report presented a preliminary design for a satellite. That year, a Yale astrophysicist named Lyman Spitzer produced a report for RAND called Astronomical Advantages of an Extraterrestrial Observatory. Free of atmospheric attenuation, such an instrument would be better able to detect visible light from the universe than could any ground-based telescope, and also able to detect bands of light almost entirely blocked by the atmosphere, such as ultraviolet and infrared. The Hubble Space Telescope is Spitzer's legacy. Soon the newly independent U.S. Air Force, which until 1947 had been the Army Air Force, began to compete internally with the Army and Navy for military primacy in space R&D. The Air Force and RAND focused on the feasibility of the satellites themselves, while the Army and Navy focused on the missiles, the rockets, that would boost the satellites into orbit. Different factions had different priorities. By early 1949, the satellite's potential for prestige and reconnaissance clearly outweighed its potential as a weapons platform. The idea that a satellite could be an excellent meteorological tool also emerged. By the time Harry Truman left the Oval Office in January 1953, the groundwork had been laid for a U.S. space program that would be politically and militarily advantageous, but not simply a pipeline for new generations of weaponry. Cold War rocket research in the Soviet Union started off as a means to a different end, the delivery of a nuclear bomb to the continental United States. Stalin, for whom the danger was not the atomic bomb as such, but the American monopoly of the bomb, fast-tracked work on a Soviet bomb within days after Hiroshima, devoting seven times as much funding to it from 1947 through 1949 as was allocated in the same period to developing a rocket capable of carrying that bomb to any target on Earth's surface. The first Soviet nuclear test, an atomic bomb with a plutonium core, similar to the A-bomb that the United States dropped on Nagasaki, took place in August 1949. The first Soviet test of an H-bomb took place 4 years later, with an explosive yield almost 20 times that of the A-bomb. Now the issue of delivery moved to the forefront. Despite Stalin's early lack of interest in his country's missile program, Soviet progress was swift and substantial. The Soviet trophy brigades that plundered Germany's V-2 worksites in the spring and early summer of 1945 initially regarded the huge rocket as nothing more than a glorified artillery projectile. Yet by 1947, Soviet missile designers, under the supervision of the indefatigable Sergei Korolev, and aided by captured German rocket scientists, had not only mastered the construction of the V-2 themselves, but had convinced the nascent missile industry to develop an ICBM with a range of almost 2,000 miles, 10 times farther than that of the V-2. Within a few years, Korolev's first deputy had proposed that the goal be at least twice that. By late 1953, the missile designers were being told to develop an ICBM capable of carrying a 6-ton payload. Such a huge capacity was twice the mass Korolev and his team had been expecting. But that unexpected challenge had an upside for the USSR. Any rocket powerful enough to carry a heavy bomb would also be able to lift a satellite into Earth orbit. While some members of the military-industrial sector focused on the Soviet bomb and others focused on the Soviet missile, a few took up the mantle of their countryman Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, who decades earlier had thought about multi-stage rockets as an efficient way to launch a satellite. Well-placed Tsiolkovsky followers, along with legions of civilian space enthusiasts and popularizers, dreamed of a Soviet entry into space. Foremost among them was an aeronautical engineer named Mikhail Tikhonravov, a comrade of Sergei Korolev's, who worked at the think tank NII4, the Soviet counterpart to RAND, and who was a key part of the USSR's space program from Sputnik to Gagarin. In 1951, Tikhonravov created a small satellite research team at NII4 in the fall of 1953, half a year after Stalin's death. NII4 expanded the team into a full-scale secret project, research into the problems of creating an artificial satellite of the Earth, codenamed Theme Number 72. The problems ranged from putting a satellite in orbit to using a satellite as a bombing platform. So by the end of 1953, less than a year after the termination of both Stalin's and Truman's time at the helm, the two Cold War adversaries had established their space agenda as well as their space personnel. The following year, the IGY resolution forced them to deliver. Competition crystallized. IGY's satellite project soon metamorphosed from an idealistic, supranational collaboration of truth-seeking scientists, to whatever extent it had been so, into a fight for alpha status between American imperialism and the Red Menace. Meanwhile, East Asia, though caught up in damaging, convoluted confrontations involving both superpowers, was also mobilizing for space. Rocket scientists in Japan used the upcoming IGY as the rationale for developing homegrown rockets for atmospheric research. Mao's China was on the brink of welcoming back the man who would jumpstart its space program, Qian Suisen, a Chinese-born professor of aeronautics at Caltech and MIT, a founding member of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and a member of the elite scientific advisory group set up during World War II to advise the U.S. military on the possibilities for wartime air power. So valuable was Qian to America's rocket research that in April 1945, despite his not being a U.S. citizen, he was given the title Expert Consultant and the temporary rank of Colonel in the U.S. Air Force so that he could deploy to Germany and interrogate the V-2 scientists, including Wernher von Braun, who had just handed themselves over to the Americans. Yet, in 1950, during the heyday of America's Red Scare, Qian was accused, without evidence, of being a member of the Communist Party and was soon robbed of his security clearance and professional opportunities. In 1955, minus his papers and belongings, he was deported to China. As a former Undersecretary of the Navy famously said, his deportation was the stupidest thing this country ever did. Within a few years, Chien Sui-sen had become his country's Sergei Korolev. Vilification of communism by the West and of imperialism by the East was standard practice by the time Chien returned to his country of birth. The House Committee on Un-American Activities had poisoned U.S. politics. Winston Churchill had introduced the term Iron Curtain to the free world in 1946 after having tried out Iron Fence. Truman had delivered his Truman Doctrine speech to Congress in March 1947, calling for the United States henceforth to support free peoples and oppose totalitarian regimes anywhere and everywhere at a 1947 price tag of $400 million. Peacetime militarization, too, was on the rise. Security had become a prime focus of policy. The National Security Act of 1947 completely overhauled the structure of the U.S. military, establishing the Department of Defense to replace the three separate military services and creating the National Security Council and the Central Intelligence Agency. The Secretary of War disappeared, his cabinet post taken over by the Secretary of Defense. The North Atlantic Treaty, which gave birth to NATO, was signed in April 1949. Its purpose, according to the American consensus, was to create not merely a balance of power, but a preponderance of power. Alarmed at the possibility of capitalist encirclement, the USSR responded forcefully to the flurry of free world rhetoric and military economic institution building in the West. In 1946, the Soviet Union refused to join the newly formed U.S.-dominated World Bank and International Monetary Fund, dashing American hopes that an influx of dollars would induce a Soviet retreat from Eastern Europe. In 1947, having failed to gain traction during planning sessions for the Marshall Plan, the Soviet foreign minister began work on the Molotov Plan for the Eastern Bloc. In late June 1948, the Soviet Union imposed what turned into a year-long blockade of all surface routes from Allied-occupied Western Germany to the Western-occupied sectors of Berlin, a blockade made possible because the entire city of Berlin is located far inside what was then the Soviet occupation zone. During Stalin's last couple of years in power, as his hopes, fears, demands, and missteps in Germany, Korea, China, Japan, and much of Eastern Europe gave rise to increasingly unpalatable conditions, he began a second round of political purges, reviving the 1936 through 1938 campaign that had thrown Sergei Korolev into a series of labor camps and penitentiaries for many years and sent hundreds of thousands of other Russians, notable and ordinary, military and literary, to their death. One top-secret document that exemplifies the fraught politics and charged political language of the early Cold War and encapsulates America's foreign policy during much of the second half of the 20th century is NSC 68, a report to the National Security Council by the Executive Secretary on United States objectives and programs for national security, dated April 14, 1950. In NSC 68, the United States has a lofty fundamental purpose to assure the integrity and vitality of our free society, which is founded upon the dignity and worth of the individual. While the Soviet Union has an insidious fundamental design to retain and solidify their absolute power, which calls for the complete subversion or forcible destruction of the machinery of government and structure of society in the countries of the non-Soviet world, Once the usual paeans to freedom have been reiterated in a suitable number of paragraphs, hardly a page omits mention of the pressing need to increase U.S. military power as a counterweight to the USSR's program for world domination. The Soviet Union's increased atomic capability and pursuit of militarization combined to back up infiltration with intimidation. On the one hand, the report acknowledges, resort to war is not only a last resort for a free society, but it is also an act which cannot definitively end the fundamental conflict in the realm of ideas. On the other hand, only if we had overwhelming atomic superiority and obtained command of the air might the USSR be deterred from deploying its atomic weapons as we progressed toward the attainment of our objectives. What to do? Business as usual won't work. Isolationism won't work. Negotiation on its own won't really work, though we must appear willing to participate. An outright war would be unpalatable to the population. The only sensible course of action is a rapid buildup of political, economic, and military strength in the free world. The United States will need a military shield to shelter all non-military initiatives, which is exactly what happened. U.S. military spending soon tripled, from 5% of gross domestic product in 1950 to more than 14% of a growing economy in 1953, a tripling concurrent with the Korean War, often called the first hot conflict of the Cold War. For its part, from 1951 to 1952, the Soviet Union almost doubled the size of the Red Army and increased military spending by 50%. On July 29, 1955, 9 months after the Rome Resolution, the National Science Foundation and the National Academy of Sciences issued a joint press release declaring the United States' intention to construct a small, unmanned, Earth-circling satellite vehicle to be used for basic scientific observations during the forthcoming International Geophysical Year. The target of those observations would be extraterrestrial radiations and geophysical phenomena. On the same day, echoing the NSF-NAS press release, Eisenhower's press secretary announced the president's approval of plans for the launching of small unmanned Earth-circling satellites, so that scientists throughout the world could make sustained observations in the regions beyond the Earth's atmosphere. Soon afterward, the Navy's satellite proposal, Project Vanguard, beat out those of the Army and the Air Force, even though the Army, which had rocket scientist Wernher von Braun on its payroll, may well have had a better shot at succeeding. Within a year, Vanguard was incurring cost overruns and technical problems. Various Eisenhower administration officials, however, now convinced of the importance of being the first nation to place a satellite in orbit, fought its termination. Once the Americans had declared their intent, the Soviets visibly quickened their pace. As Bernard Lovell, director of Britain's Jodrell Bank Radio Telescope Observatory, and witness to the first months of the space race, later wrote, "At that stage, no one could accuse the Soviet Union of lacking in frankness about its space program." On July 30, 1955, just one day after the NSF-NAS announcement, the Soviet Union came out with a similar announcement. On September 25, Sergei Korolev gave an unprecedented public lecture at which he proclaimed that his country's goals should rightly be that the first artificial satellite of the Earth be Soviet, created by the Soviet people, and to have Soviet rockets and rocket ships be the first to fly in the limitless expanse of the universe. The year 1957 was mentioned far and wide as the target date. At the end of January 1956, the USSR's Council of Ministers decreed that the country would launch an artificial satellite sometime in 1957. In late 1956, the CIA warned the president that the Soviet Union would orbit a satellite anytime after early 1957, and alerted the National Security Council in early 1957 that the Soviets had tested a 1-to-5 kiloton atomic weapon affixed to a missile. A missile powerful enough to launch a satellite. The early October launch of Sputnik erased all remaining doubts. Some analysts maintain that the Eisenhower administration, intentionally or inadvertently, either allowed the Soviet Union to go first, or was hugely relieved when it did so, because the historic flight of the first world-circling satellite effectively resolved the fraught issue of freedom of space, whether flights through the airspace above the territory of another country violated that country's sovereignty. Insistence on vertical sovereignty and prohibitions against overflights would mean that a country deemed military satellite reconnaissance illegal. But now, having launched the first satellite, the Soviets had unwittingly placed themselves in a position where they could hardly argue the illegality of the trespass of their own Sputnik. Thenceforth, in principle, anyone could go anywhere in space. Whatever machinations and mishaps may or may not have taken place behind the scenes, Sputnik was a world-changing banner headline event. The first phase of its success was the perfection of an extremely powerful intercontinental ballistic missile, the R-7 rocket. On August 21, 1957, the rocket flew 4,000 miles to the remote northeastern Kamchatka Peninsula. Once the USSR had mastered the means of transport, pointedly announced by the Soviet news agency TASS as a military achievement, it could focus more intensively on the new payload, a satellite rather than a bomb. At 22 hours, 28 minutes, 34 seconds, Moscow time, on October 4, 1957, very early in IGY and 3 years to the day after the Rome Resolution, the Soviet Union launched the first Sputnik, a glossy, silvery, radio-beeping, 184-pound sphere the size of a beach ball. The front page of Pravda called it a great victory in the global competition with capitalism. A month later, the Soviets launched a second Sputnik, 6 times as heavy as the first. The score was now USSR 2, USA 0. 3 days later, President Eisenhower announced the appointment of America's first science advisor, a post that could almost have dated from the days of President Lincoln. In 1863, with much to distract him, Lincoln nonetheless signed into existence the National Academy of Sciences, an association of independent scientists whose task then and still was to provide informed advice to the executive and congressional branches of the government. America's agenda in space demanded a more sharply defined role for science. Eisenhower, who had served as supreme commander of the Allied Expeditionary Forces during World War II, recognized that no modern country could be militarily preeminent without also being scientifically eminent. On the last day of January 1958, the U.S. Army successfully launched its Explorer 1 satellite. A couple of months later, the U.S. Navy's Vanguard 1 reached orbit as well. Americans who had been paying attention as one American rocket after another turned into a greasy fireball down in Florida could now hold their heads a little higher. But multiple failures followed in the wake of the first successes. The Cold War was in high fever. America's pundits, policymakers, and professors were suddenly justifiably frantic. Space journalist William E. Burroughs caustically frames the situation. Not only were the Reds militarily muscular and infinitely devious, but it turned out that they were apparently superbly educated as well, particularly in science and engineering. Every Soviet student took 5 years each of physics and math, it was reported, while a mere quarter of their lackluster American counterparts took one lone course in physics. Time for some government mobilization. Early in 1958, mere months after Sputnik, brand new standing committees on space and aeronautics were rushed into existence in both houses of Congress with Lyndon Johnson, then Senate Majority Leader, as chair of the upper chamber's committee. In February, the Advanced Research Projects Agency, ARPA, soon to become DARPA, with a D for defense, was established, serving as America's de facto national space agency until the beginning of October, when the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, opened for business. At the end of July, the National Aeronautics and Space Act of 1958 was passed. In mid-August, the National Security Council issued its secret preliminary U.S. policy on outer space, which unequivocally stated that any use of outer space, whatever the purpose it is intended to serve, may have some degree of military or other non-peaceful application. In September, the National Defense Education Act, emphasizing support for math and science, was signed into law. Not since the influential 1945 report to the president, Science, the Endless Frontier, had the link between science education and national security and the necessity of government support for science been so explicitly formulated. Finally, in October 1958, came the official launch not only of NASA, but of America's first pioneer space probe. Science, the Endless Frontier, written by the director of the Wartime Office of Scientific Research and Development, had flatly declared that science is a proper concern of government, and that it was essential to create a civilian-controlled organization funded by Congress, committed to freedom of inquiry, and empowered to initiate military research which will supplement and strengthen that carried on directly under the control of the Army and Navy. The result was the creation of the National Science Foundation in 1950. Thinking along similar lines specifically about space, Eisenhower was convinced that the highest priority should go, of course, to space research with a military application. But, he added, because national morale and to some extent national prestige could be affected by the results of peaceful space research, this should likewise be pushed. The way to push it, urged his vice president, Richard Nixon, would be to set up a separate agency. That separate agency was NASA, the most peaceable version of a space agency that a nuclear superpower could be expected to create. At the same time, the Eisenhower administration funded investigations into new anti-missile technologies under the umbrella of a new venture, Project Defender. One Defender proposal was known by the name of a sweet little Disney deer, Bambi, the acronym for Ballistic Missile Boost Intercepts. Envisioned as hundreds of space-based battle stations that would use infrared to track enemy missile exhaust and then release a rocket-propelled weapon, Bambi was anything but sweet. To help disable the ascending enemy missile, the weapon would release a huge rotating wire net studded with steel pellets. Although canceled in 1963, Bambi presaged Star Wars' brilliant pebbles 2 decades later. Another Project Defender aspirant was an orbiting battle station with several thousand nuclear weapons. While all this space activity was happening in Washington, on the other side of the planet, the Soviet Union was no less busy, launching its third Sputnik in May 1958, and preparing its Luna satellites. One of them would orbit the moon, another would land on the moon, A third would photograph the moon, all during 1959. By then, some U.S. space scientists had ceded space preeminence to the Soviets, as evidenced in a formerly top-secret report on lunar research submitted to the Air Force Special Weapons Center in 1959. The report suggests that U.S. scientific committees shouldn't concern themselves with potential lunar contamination by visiting astronauts, since the first moonfall is very likely to be by a Soviet vehicle. The space racers had good reason to fear each other. Bombardment satellites were on both sides' agendas, as were plans to detonate a nuclear bomb on the moon. 4 decades later, the primary author of that top-secret 1959 U.S. report on lunar research said in an interview, "It was clear the main aim of the proposed detonation was a PR exercise and a show of one-upmanship. The Air Force wanted a mushroom cloud so large it would be visible on Earth. The U.S. was lagging behind in the space race. The explosion would obviously be best on the dark side of the moon, and the theory was that if the bomb exploded on the edge of the moon, the mushroom cloud would be illuminated by the sun." Thankfully, the thinking changed. "I am horrified that such a gesture to sway public opinion was ever considered." In any case, some sectors of public opinion were already heading in a more constructive direction. On November 14, 1957, within an overall disarmament resolution, Resolution 1148, the UN General Assembly invoked outer space for the first time, calling for the joint study of an inspection system designed to ensure that the sending of objects through outer space shall be exclusively for peaceful and scientific purposes. On the same day, the General Assembly declared its general alarm in Resolution 1149, collective action to inform and enlighten the peoples of the world as to the dangers of the armaments race, and particularly as to the destructive effects of modern weapons, which called for a global publicity campaign to help alert the entire populace of the world that the armaments race, owing to advances of nuclear science and other modern forms of technology, creates means whereby unprecedented devastation might be inflicted upon the entire world. 13 months later, in December 1958, the General Assembly proposed and adopted its first resolution devoted specifically to space. Resolution 1348. Question on the peaceful use of outer space. Followed by more resolutions in 1959, 1961, 1962, 1963, 1965, and 1966. From the viewpoint of a U.S. diplomat deeply involved in disarmament and space policy at the time, the 2-year lead-up to the 1963 UN resolution was the breakthrough, setting the terms under which peace might be preserved in space. Although a resolution is less potent than a treaty, it may have been the more achievable option, given the prevailing political climate, hot on the heels of the terrifying superpower standoff known as the Cuban Missile Crisis in the fall of 1962, and the Senate's 80-19 approval in September 1963 of the groundbreaking Limited Test Ban Treaty, the very existence of which could be substantially chalked up to the near catastrophe over Cuba. At long last, in October 1967, during the presidency of Lyndon Baines Johnson, the United Nations Pioneering Outer Space Treaty, full title, Treaty on Principles Governing the Activities of States in the Exploration and Use of Outer Space, including the Moon and Other Celestial Bodies, became international law. Space, it declared, would be the province of all mankind. Only peaceable and scientific activities would be acceptable, No weapons testing, no fortifications, no military maneuvers, although the use of military personnel for scientific research or for any other peaceful purposes was to be permitted. The key word here is peaceful. Like defense, it's a slippery concept. In their day, Presidents Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson wanted to differentiate the non-aggressive militarization of space from the weaponization of space. Their collective time in office was strongly shaped by America's official identification of the Soviet Union as the primary threat to the security, free institutions, and fundamental values of the United States, and by America's identification of itself as leader of the free world. They wanted to distinguish between the right to use weapons under certain circumstances and the sustained condition of weaponization, between extensive military preparedness and militarism, between passive military satellites and active space weapons, between stabilizing deterrence and the proactive pursuit of dominance coupled with a readiness to destroy. Juxtaposed with disarmament, such distinctions might seem overly subtle, maybe even duplicitous, but they're not irrelevant. An unarmed U.S. Air Force reconnaissance satellite, mindlessly collecting data as it circles the Earth, is undoubtedly military, but also, strictly in itself, non-aggressive. Its mission is information, not destruction. Whereas a U.S. Air Force Space Command satellite, circling nearby, if fitted with a constellation of interceptor missiles, could have lethal consequences for wide swaths of life and civilization from one moment to the next. During the lead-up to the Outer Space Treaty, all three presidents did what presidents often do. They operated simultaneously on multiple, often opposing tracks, and on both sides of almost every fence. As they gave something to this faction, then placated another faction, engaging in brinksmanship here, avoidance there, and accommodation in between, they maneuvered along a quasi-middle path through a dense forest of contradictions amid hundreds of simultaneous competing conflicts, large and small. They pursued weapons along with diplomacy. They vociferously proclaimed the benefits of international cooperation along with the necessity for anti-Soviet mobilization. They tried, as one military historian put it, to convince the world of America's noble intentions while also ensuring that the United States maintained the ability to fight for the peaceful use of space. In the words of Sinclair Lewis from his 1935 novel, It Can't Happen Here, every statesman and clergyman praised peace and brightly asserted that the only way to get peace was to get ready for war. All the while, close at hand, loomed the specter of nuclear confrontation between the superpowers. Only international cooperation on disarmament could banish it. Dwight D. Eisenhower, military but not militaristic, a five-star general who had served as Supreme Allied Commander in Europe from December 1943 through May 1945, wanted both peace and preparedness. Pre-Sputnik, Eisenhower dismissed huge expenditures on weaponry as just negative stuff adding nothing to the earning capability of the country. He maintained that he wanted to get the federal government out of any unnecessary activity and to stop the hysterical approach to curing every ill through infusions of cash. In the spring of 1953, 3 short months into his first term, he told the American Society of Newspaper Editors, "Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired, signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are not clothed. We pay for a single fighter plane with 500,000 bushels of wheat. we pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron. At the beginning of his second term, in his State of the Union address of 1957, Eisenhower described the nation's military as the most powerful in our peacetime history and a major deterrent to war, warning that it could punish heavily any enemy who undertakes to attack us. But he also proclaimed the nation's quest for peace. A sound and safeguarded agreement for open skies, unarmed aerial sentinels, and reduced armament would provide a valuable contribution toward a durable peace in the years ahead. And we have been persistent in our effort to reach such an agreement. We are willing to enter any reliable agreement which would reverse the trend toward ever more devastating nuclear weapons, reciprocally provide against the possibility of surprise attack, mutually control the outer space missile and satellite development, and make feasible a lower level of armaments and armed forces and an easier burden of military expenditures. President Eisenhower's preferred agenda may have been peace, but the National Security Council's was preparedness. In early 1955, in answer to the NSC's concerns, 42 prominent scientists, engineers, corporate CEOs, and university presidents, the Science Advisory Committee's Technological Capabilities Panel, produced the top secret document known as the Killian Report. Meeting the threat of surprise attack, they examined the likely timetable for increases in both U.S. and Soviet capabilities and multi-megaton weapons, jet bombers, and intercontinental ballistic missiles, the latter two being the delivery systems for the former. In addition, they recommended a slew of measures to fortify America's arsenal. Foremost among them was the immediate funding of an intercontinental ballistic missile with a range of 5,500 nautical miles, which would put Moscow within striking range of launch locations in the continental United States. Other measures urged by the panel: convince Canada to give the United States authority for instant use of atomic warheads over Canadian territory, extend radar coverage hundreds of miles northward and seaward from U.S. continental boundaries, develop interceptor aircraft to conduct air-to-air combat at very high altitudes, including the launch of guided missiles, design an artificial satellite transmission system for stronger and safer communication of critical strategic warning data, and develop advanced technology for intelligence acquisition. That last listed task was soon turned over to Lockheed Aircraft's aerospace futurists, Skunk Works, who swiftly devised the U-2, a stratospheric photoreconnaissance plane that would fly beyond the range of contemporary anti-aircraft measures. By late 1957, many of the panel's recommendations were being implemented. In a radio and television address on science and national security, broadcast 1 month after the triumph of Sputnik, Eisenhower assured his listeners that the United States has today and has had for some years enough power in its strategic retaliatory forces to bring near annihilation to the war-making capabilities of any other country. He spoke about the U.S. arsenal in some detail and painted a picture of a militaristic Soviet Union, but then switched to his preferred theme, now framed in terms of space. What the world needs today, even more than a giant leap into outer space, is a giant step toward peace. In January of the following year, he sent a letter to the Soviet Premier Nikolai Bulganin, Nikita Khrushchev's predecessor, proposing that we agree that outer space be used only for peaceful purposes, Another detente-seeking letter sent in February suggested wholly eliminating the newest types of weapons which use outer space for human destruction. The dual-track approach of regularly calling for peace while intensively preparing for war was firmly established by the time Congress passed the cornerstone of America's space program, the National Aeronautics and Space Act of 1958. Its opening paragraph, Section 102A, declares that activities in space should be devoted to peaceful purposes for the benefit of all mankind. Section 102B then expends many more words declaring space activities to be the providence of a civilian agency, except when they are not. Activities peculiar to or primarily associated with the development of weapons systems, military operations, or the defense of the United States, including the research and development necessary to make effective provision for the defense of the United States, shall be the responsibility of and shall be directed by the Department of Defense. Note that the development of weapons systems is listed first, separately from defense of the United States. While giving a diplomatic nod to peaceful purposes, Congress leaves no doubt that the militarization and weaponization of space are inevitable. President Eisenhower maneuvered through the war, peace, diplomacy minefield in the usual way, back and forth, periodically invoking the benefits of peace as well as the drawbacks and high costs of the arms race. All the while, he presided over a swift post-Sputnik expansion of the nation's intercontinental and intermediate-range ballistic missile programs, as well as initiatives dedicated to military and dual-use space hardware. Reconnaissance satellites remained high on the agenda. Besides Bambi and Project Defender's other costly top-secret initiatives, Eisenhower-era military space efforts included the WS-117L, WS for Weapons System, Reconnaissance Satellite, the MIDAS, Missile Defense Alarm System, Missile Detection Satellite, intended to provide a 30-minute advance warning of an incoming Soviet ICBM attack rather than the 15-minute warning available through ground-based early warning systems, the SAMOS Satellite and Missile Observation System, Photographic and Electromagnetic Data Collection Satellite, and Project Corona, a joint effort of the CIA and the Air Force that superseded both the WS-117L and SAMOS and that largely took over reconnaissance tasks previously performed by the CIA's U-2 spy planes. Among the dual-use systems, valuable to both military and non-military users, were TIROS, Television Infrared Observation Satellite, a weather satellite jointly developed by NASA and the Army Materiel Command, and the Navy's Transit Navigation Satellites. Both began as strictly military programs, but were eventually made available to civilians, as would later happen with the Navistar Global Positioning System, GPS, whose value to the U.S. economy will soon be upward of $100 billion a year. Other militarily important initiatives from the Eisenhower years included first-generation communications satellites, ECHO, an inflatable Mylar sphere that could serve as a passive relay for radio signals, SCORE, which could transmit a pre-recorded message, and Courier, which could both store and transmit data. Almost all communication satellites circle Earth in a geostationary orbit, GEO, synchronized with Earth's rotation. Just like Earth, they take exactly one day to complete one orbit, so they appear to hover over a selected spot. The idea that GEO would be a good place for communication satellites to live and work was first explored in 1945 by the futurist Arthur C. Clarke in a detailed article that posed the question, Can rocket stations give worldwide radio coverage? Yes, they can. And yes, they do. Ways to intercept enemy satellites and ballistic missiles also began in earnest under Eisenhower, as did the idea of putting constellations of bombardment satellites into orbit. The Air Force, hoping to displace NASA as the leading edge of America's space exploits, independently designed a crewed, reusable, surveillance and bombing space plane called Dinosaur, which, if it hadn't been canceled before being flown even once, would have been launched on a rocket, aerodynamically glided around Earth in the mid-stratosphere at an altitude of 60 miles, and landed like an airplane. Suborbitally, the Air Force teamed up with NASA to research the effects of hypersonic speeds, extremely high altitudes, and atmospheric re-entry on the joint airplane, the X-15. Much of the actual and potential militarization of space took place because of Senator Lyndon B. Johnson, a Texas Democrat, who had seized on space as a promising issue for his party. The Republican president may have wanted to downplay the importance of Sputnik and not explicitly race the Reds, but that soon became impossible. A couple of weeks after the launch of the second Sputnik, Johnson, acting as chair of the Preparedness Investigating Subcommittee of the powerful Senate Armed Services Committee, began several months of hearings on what would be needed for America to dominate space. These hearings, according to one of the drafters of the National Aeronautics and Space Act of 1958, were conducted in an emergency atmosphere of deep concern with the status of U.S. national defense. Senator Johnson was ascendant. The day before Eisenhower's State of the Union speech in January 1958, Johnson told the Senate Democratic Caucus, "Control of space means control of the world. If out in space there is the ultimate position from which total control of the earth may be exercised, then our national goal and the goal of all free men must be to win and hold that position." The Democrats crushed the Republicans in the November 1958 congressional election. Almost immediately, Johnson began jockeying to preempt Eisenhower's foreign policy team. He also convinced President Eisenhower to let him address the UN General Assembly in mid-November 1958 in support of a U.S. draft resolution calling for a committee on the peaceful uses of outer space. The resolution passed. In his speech, Senator Johnson, for whom on a Wednesday in January, U.S. dominance had been the only tolerable agenda, was ready to declare on a Monday in November that cooperation was the only true path forward. "Today, outer space is free. It is unscarred by conflict. No nation holds a concession there. It must remain this way. We of the United States do not acknowledge that there are landlords of outer space who can presume to bargain with the nations of the earth on the price of access to this new domain. We know the gains of cooperation. We know the losses of failure to cooperate. If we fail now to apply the lessons we have learned, or even if we delay their application, we know that the advances into space may only mean adding a new dimension to warfare. Men who have worked together to reach the stars are not likely to descend together into the depths of war and desolation." Persuasive rhetoric. But by now it's clear that what passed for attempts at cooperation consisted mostly of fig leaves meant to embarrass or set back the other side's progress, writes James Clay Moltz of the Department of National Security Affairs at the Naval Postgraduate School. To Everett Dolman of the School of Advanced Air and Space Studies at the U.S. Air Force's Air University, cooperation was a fiction. Expansion into near-Earth space came not as the accommodating effort of many nations joined as one, but rather as an integral component of an overall strategy applied by wary superstates attempting to ensure their political survival. Khrushchev himself saw cooperation as an avenue to be pursued from a position of strength. we felt we needed time to test, perfect, produce, and install an effective weapon. Once we provided for the defense of our country, then we could begin space cooperation with the United States. In the fall of 1960, during his last few months in office, President Eisenhower proposed to the UN General Assembly that there be a targeted ban, subject to verification, on the orbiting or stationing of weapons of mass destruction in space. It would be a small step toward cooperation to keep outer space from becoming another focus for the arms race, and thus an area of dangerous and sterile competition. As with its predecessors, it remained a proposal, a glimpse of the possible. A little like recent proposals to reduce global greenhouse gas emissions or to guarantee universal health care in America, implementation lay well in the future. Soon both President Kennedy and Chairman Khrushchev would take up the issue, each in his own way. In the 1960 election, John F. Kennedy ran in part on closing the fictive missile gap with the Soviet Union and on the need to beat the Soviets in space. After all, Khrushchev had said he was turning out ICBMs like sausages. Kennedy's victory over Richard Nixon meant that money might be lavished on both a high-profile civilian race to the moon and closed-door military work. The names of Eisenhower-era space reconnaissance satellites vanished under a shroud of code names. Also, unlike Eisenhower's public position that the two strands of space activity must be kept separate, the Kennedy administration's and the Air Force's position was that both strands were part of a single mission, to preserve space as a domain of non-aggression. Kennedy's budget for military space spending in 1963 was $1.5 billion, almost triple what Eisenhower's had been in 1960. Meanwhile, NASA's budget skyrocketed sixfold, from $400 million in 1960 to more than $2.5 billion in 1963. Congress and the American people had been prepped for the civilian portion of those billions during Kennedy's speech to a joint session of Congress on May 25, 1961, in which he proposed landing on the moon as a great new American enterprise. 6 weeks earlier, Yuri Gagarin had become the first human to orbit Earth, while America had not yet perfected an astronaut-ready rocket that wouldn't explode on launch. Intent on shoring up America's faltering prestige through a stunning commitment to space projects, Kennedy sought to make America the guarantor and facilitator of world peace. In space, he maintained, U.S. non-aggressive militarization would be able to neutralize Soviet aggression. Our arms do not prepare for war. They are efforts to discourage and resist the adventures of others that could end in war. The classic distinction between defensive and offensive weapons, between the good intentions of the good guys and the bad intentions of the bad guys. Kennedy began his speech with a crusader's vow to defend freedom. Our strength as well as our convictions have imposed upon this nation the role of leader in freedom's cause, and concluded with a biblical call for an end to war. We will make clear America's enduring concern is for both peace and freedom, that we are anxious to live in harmony with the Russian people, that we seek no conquests, no satellites, no riches, that we seek only the day when nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. The Soviet Union had heard that claim before, when Stalin was still alive and Molotov was his foreign minister. After more than a decade of repetition, the assertion that the expansionist United States had no desire to conquer surely rang hollow to its expansionist adversary in the East. In early June, less than 2 weeks after Kennedy's speech to Congress, a team of authors from NASA and the Department of Defense issued a report titled The National Space Program, which, despite its classified status, scrubbed virtually all mention of military applications. No references to ASATs or ballistic missile defense programs occur in these pages, even though work on them had already been pursued for half a decade. Outdoing the Soviet Union